Welcome to the intersection of theater and even more theater. You have achieved stage grok. Stage Grok, the roaming theater podcast, coming to you from the geographic center of the American Theater. I'm your host, Scott Miller. Today I talk with Broadway director Michael Mayer on the phone with me from New York about the creation of American Idiot.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to me today. The main thing I want to talk to you about, since I'm in the middle of working on American Idiot, is the genesis of American Idiot. So the first thing I wanted to ask you about were you the guy who first said, hey, we should make this a musical?
Yes.
And when what appealed to you about it? What made you think it would work as a stage piece?
I wasn't sure it would, but I had a gut feeling about it. And honestly, it was the material itself spoke to me very, very strongly as I was listening to the record, and I sort of became a little obsessed with it. I listened to it all the time. And it started to sound to me like an original cast album.
Yeah.
I had the same relationship to it as a record that I had to the show albums that I would listen to as a kid. And I knew it wasn't show music or anything like that. It's just it took me on an emotional journey.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what it was. And I started to really connect to the narrative of the Jesus of suburbia, going to the city and meeting the girl and having this alter ego named St. Jimmy and then coming home again. It was a very simple narrative, but it started to really work on me. And at a certain point, I guess it was after Spring Awakening had cleaned up at the Tonys. That it was that summer that someone, I think it was Gordon Cox in Variety, I think, asked me about other albums or other rock music or contemporary music, like rock music or indie rock music, that kind of thing. If there was any other composer other than Duncan Sheik that was appealing to me, and I think I said something to the effect of, well, somebody has got to be doing an American Idiot musical because it's ready to go. I mean, so much of it is written already.
Yeah.
And Tom Hulse, my producer of, one of my producers on Spring Awakening, literally called me when that interview came out, and he said, are you serious about American Idiot? And I said, yeah. He said, should we pursue this? And I said, oh, right. Yeah, Green Day. Green Day is really going to want to do a Broadway musical. I said, like, knock yourself out, Tom. And cut to 6 weeks later or less, and we are sitting in the agent for Green Day, Jenna Adler, CAA, and with her and with Pat Magnarella, who is Green Day's manager, pitching this idea to them, and they didn't look at us like we were nuts.
So they immediately saw that it was at least a decent idea right away.
Well, I think what they thought was that it wasn't a terrible idea.
Right.
And they were open.
Do you think Spring Awakening helped that?
It totally helped because it helped me with credibility for me and for Tom in terms of doing more cutting edge kind of work in the Broadway musical field.
Yeah.
And definitely the big turning point that went from this is interesting to, oh yeah, go for it. was Billy Joe coming to see Spring Awakening on Broadway.
Oh.
Which he did that fall. I think it was September, October. He came to see it, and we went out after, and as it turns out, I found out that night sitting with him afterwards that he had a whole history with musicals and and Tin Pan Alley and all that stuff from when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And he knew like a lot of songs and a lot of shows. And in fact, certain shows, in particular, I think West Side Story, he said, was very influential on the shaping of and a quick one by The Who. Those two were the things that most informed the sort of concept album that American Idiot was.
Right.
So we talked, and he said that he didn't know that a musical could do what Spring Awakening did, you know, musically,
nice.
And that it could be as challenging. So it was a wonderful night, full of possibility and enthusiasm. And Billy Joe, who was, you know, a scant rock star, was as down to earth and genuine as anyone I've ever met. And we just talked at Bar Centrale. Have you been there before?
I don't know.
It's that theater bar that's above Orso.
Oh, I think I have.
Like, yeah, but you go there and it's, you know, it's Nathan Lane and it's Laura Benanti and it's like, you know, Jerry Mitchell and, you know, it's like super Broadway, you know, it's the most like Broadway establishment of just like musicals.
Right.
And there's, you know, and there's this punk rocker sitting there with us at this booth. Nobody knows who he is because it's Broadway and, you know, this is their world.
Right.
Broadway is very popular, as they proved around Tony time for us when they gave us very little love. But Billy Joe understood the value of what could happen live on stage and gave us a really wonderful shot in the arm by saying, you should go ahead with my blessing.
Wow.
Go ahead and sort of see what you make of it.
Right.
And the deal we made was that at every juncture, they would check in with us and they could at any time pull the plug on it.
Wow.
You know, I wanted them to feel absolutely confident that they would never be in a situation where we were doing something that they couldn't get behind 100%.
Right.
And that's how it worked for the next 3 years.
I imagine that would be very comforting in a way for you and Tom Kitt, right?
Oh, well, but what's amazing is that they, you know, what was great was everything was accessible. I had his phone number. I had his email. I could text him. I could send him ideas. And before you know it, he started to send me stuff. So before you know it, I'm getting these emails from Billy Joe, and in them are these demos from the new album, 21st Century Breakdown.
Right, right.
And I'm
right.
Like, what is this? And he's like, yeah, I just wanted you to hear what we're up to. Maybe you could use some of this stuff. And, you know, that was just
what a
my,
gift.
You know, it was unexpected, thrilling. And, the, you know, that album is a masterpiece. You know, I feel
and,
like
and those songs.
Those, like, but, and then I was still, it was still too early in a way for me to figure out how to make those songs function because I didn't really have a fleshed out scenario at that point.
Right.
But it certainly did let me start to dream about ways in which some new material might help flesh out story.
Well, and it's amazing how those extra songs now feel so totally organic to your story.
Yeah.
Well,
isn't that crazy?
Well,
I think they were in the same mode too, though. I will say, yeah. Like, they were in the same creative mode that they were in for the first album when they were doing the second one. So it felt like an extension to me. And I think if you look at two albums side by side, I think they represent an incredibly impactful, you know, social, political, personal statement. You know,
yeah.
It's a very, very clear artistic thumbprint about the state of the world at that time and the state of you know, human relationships.
Right. Well, one of the things that we were very surprised by was how you guys changed so little of the material from the album. And usually a show like this, you have to make some changes. But it felt like everything seems to fit perfectly.
I had this conceit, I have to tell you. Before this new material showed up, the conceit was I was going to, and it was the challenge I gave myself. I didn't want to change anything. I was going to keep everything in the same order. I wasn't going to change a word, and I was going to be like a sculptor and take that. And fill all of those moments and make them figure out this song is dialogue. Obviously he wrote it, it's one voice basically.
Right.
And so to take it and turn it into, I'm in an elevator now, so I hope I don't lose you.
Okay.
But I'm heading up to my office. I wanted to do that. And so then when we had this new material, and also some old stuff that I found of theirs, like B-sides and stuff that I started putting in.
Nice.
I felt like it was crucial that I not interrupt the order. I couldn't change the order. I could interrupt, but I couldn't change the order.
Right.
So it was completely arbitrary on my part. And it was only because I had such respect for the actual shape of the album.
Well, it turns out to be an amazingly good choice.
It did, but it was honestly, it was a little bit of a fluke because I'm not, you know, by trade, a writer per se.
Yeah.
You know, I've been very heavily involved in the dramaturgy and the conceptions of stuff that, like Spring Awakening, and like 10 Million Miles.
I notice on the original Green Day album, Billy Joel has kind of written his own little autobiographical hero myth story as
right.
Suburbia. You broke that into three separate stories where three guys have kind of different hero myth journeys, and I'm mm-hmm. curious about the choice to break it up.
Okay, what I was trying to say was that it might be because Green Day is three guys.
Oh, right.
I think there's a chance that I was just being swayed by that. But again, it was a gut feeling rather than a deep thought. I just knew that, you know, you can't do a show with one person in it. It would be a one-man show. And that wasn't interesting to me. And I felt like what he's writing about is like the voice of, you know, it is, you know, it's like a cliche, but, you know, he was writing the voice of a certain generation.
Yeah.
And I really wanted that. I wanted to try to inhabit. I wanted that to inhabit more than one voice. I wanted the voice of different experiences. So all I knew going into that first meeting was that I felt very strongly that there should be three guys who are friends. I did not think it should be autobiographical. It should not be about Green Day.
Right.
But there's something about the threeness that felt somehow inevitable, maybe.
Right.
I don't know if that's right, but it felt right to me. I guess it's the bottom line. So that's what I pitched. And I said, it's about three guys who decide to get out of Dodge. Shit happens to them. And that's all I knew when I pitched.
What would you say our three guys learn by the end, or maybe all three of them don't?
I don't know how much they learn, to tell you the truth. I know that...
I feel like Johnny at least got that classic...
wherever, you know, whatever you're looking for is probably inside.
Yeah. He's definitely the Wizard of Oz version.
Right.
Right. And I talked about the Wizard of Oz a lot as a template, you know.
That's our great American hero, man.
Yeah, of course. If I ever go searching for my heart's desire, I won't look any further than my own backyard, because if it isn't
right
there, I never really lost it to begin with. Which, if you think about it, actually doesn't make any sense. So, I mean, I love it. And you sort of get the idea, but if you diagram that sentence, it actually has no meaning other than the vague sense that you can accomplish everything inside yourself. I mean, that's what I think of home. I think of home as the ultimate journey back to yourself.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's an internal journey, which is sometimes difficult to dramatize on stage, but with these songs, you know, really busting open what's inside these guys, you really get an opportunity to make it theatrical, if not dramatic, you know? So I think that Johnny, I think his journey is from a naive sense of rebellion.
Yeah.
To understanding how much work it actually takes, like deep personal work it takes to have, to become the person that you want to be.
Right.
So I think that's his thing, and how dangerous it is to allow an idea. Like if St. Jimmy is really just an idea in his own head, or an actual other person, how dangerous it is to allow an idea of yourself or another person, if you let them in too deeply, and how seductive the dark side can be, you know, when love is the other option. Because I really do think he's got the potential of love with what's-her-name, and this other thing keeps calling to him because of some crazy idea that he's got in his head. Tunney, I think what he learns is that there is ultimately going to be some kind of sacrifice required in life. And he's the most angry, the most pugnacious, and the most sort of unwilling to compromise, I guess. He's the least compromising of them. And so he goes thinking like it's all got to be gung-ho, you know, just gung-ho all the time. And he ends up learning the hard way that sometimes you've got to give something in order to get something. The trade-off he makes is a leg for, you know, for love and peace. And then Will, he's the only one that I really named with, you know, intentionality, like thinking about, like, in a Shakespearean way, like where people have
characters
have names
that
are like that. And I feel like his whole, he is an absolute product of inertia, and he has Will. The Will is Will-free, in a sense, which means that he's separated from himself. He is without himself, so it's impossible for him to move forward. So he just goes deeper and deeper into what is comfortable and what is the path of least resistance, because he doesn't actually have the will to move forward. And at the very end, I think you get the sense that he's going to. He finally leaves the house, you know. He faces he faces Heather. He holds the baby that he has had no interest in from the beginning. And I don't know what his relationship to the marijuana is or the drinking, but you get the sense that at least he walked out of the house, which is a first step.
Yeah, I feel like all three of the boys are either growing up or getting ready to grow up, and we don't know if they're going to be okay, but at least they're
on the road.
That's right. And I think that, honestly, in this day and age, and for that generation, for there to be the hope of growing up, I think we are hard pressed to ask for more than that. That starts to become a fairy tale then. And right. what I've always been very proud of about American Idiot is that it's realistic.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And that it just feels like real life. It's ambiguous at the end, like life
yep.
is.
Yep.
It is hard, like every little inch of progress that you make is hard won because nothing gets handed to you on a silver platter.
Right.
If you're really one of the normal people in the world.
Right.
You know, you have to be exceptionally lucky to be in that 1% where, you know, you don't have to go through the personal struggles, the political struggles, the social struggles, the financial struggles,
right?
The artistic struggles, you know.
Right.
So that's something that I'm very proud of, and I feel like at the end, the audiences always feel, in every time I've seen it over the years, and every version of it, and every cast, the audience always seems energized by it. Nobody ever walks out of there feeling depressed or hopeless, even
right.
though the hope that we're offering at the end is a very real a very real dose, which is to say that it
right.
isn't like it's not like a typical Broadway musical which you know
right.
which
right.
sends you out on this cloud of, you know, helium of platitudes and false hopes of, you know, joy. And some people love that. And look, I do too. You know, I love the old-fashioned musicals as much as the next person. But I think what's great about this is that it's contemporary and it really does talk about what our lives really are.
Well, and I think that's connected. One of the things that we all loved the most was watching the documentary Broadway Idiot and watching Billy Joe Armstrong fall in love with musical theater, which I think
yeah.
is largely due to what you're talking about, that you really were taking
right.
it seriously and we're taking him seriously. And that was
yeah.
just so awesome for all of us.
Yeah, I'm glad. I mean, I have to say, after all these years, I get more responses, like more people, like call me up, you know, like tap me on the shoulder and something and say, excuse
right.
me, but did you direct American Idiot? I mean, I've been doing this for so many years, and it's really because of that documentary. It just cracks me up. And I'm really touched when they do that and they say how much they love the that movie and how much they love the show and stuff.
Yeah.
But if you had told me, you know, 25 years ago that I would be recognized on the street for having collaborated with a punk band from the Bay Area on a Broadway musical, I'd have said you were absolutely nuts.
That's awesome. All right, let me ask you one last question.
Yep.
And I love to ask this of musical theater people. I firmly believe that we are in a new golden age for the art form that started like mid-90s and we're still in
mm-hmm.
it. I'm curious if you agree with me.
I do. I think that, again, I would be very proud to say that with Spring Awakening, I was participating
yeah.
in that, you know.
Big time.
But I look at, like, the way that things have changed since then. It felt like there were these little bursts throughout the years, you know, where, like, really contemporary music and a contemporary sensibility kept filtering through to the Broadway musical, but it always felt like it was a little spurt and then it went back to the old way again. You know, you'd have
yeah.
hair and then you'd
right.
have, you know, then you'd have applause.
Right.
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 And then you have Evita, maybe, let's say, and then you'd
yeah.
have Lacage.
Right.
So there was always like these little bursts, or Tommy, the Who's Tommy, and
yeah.
everyone said, oh my God, the rock musical is back. And it wasn't. It just didn't happen. But for
right.
some reason, after Spring Awakening, then you had In the Heights, and then you have, you know, American Idiot, and we have Hamilton, and
yeah.
we have all of this other work. You even had, you know, you had U2 on Broadway, for God's sake.
Yeah. Well, and even the shows that don't run long, like Scottsboro Boys and Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson.
Absolutely. These, thank you. I mean, yeah, I don't have all of that at my fingertips, but I'm thinking of, like, there is this openness to the new generation of musical theater goers, I think, and the fans of the musical. Hedwig on Broadway. I mean, come on.
Like, yeah, that's awesome.
How is that possible, though? I mean, it's crazy. So you've got these fans who are not only open to it, but seem very hungry for it.
Yeah.
And I think that where there is demand, there will be supply.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing it now. And I, for one, could not be more thrilled. You know, for every big, you know, revival of Fiddler on the Roof, and that's always going to happen. You know, we're going to get those things. And, you know, God bless, and that's great. And a lot of people really want to see that. I think that for every one of those, I think you're going to see a half a dozen of new shows that are really, really interested in moving the form forward, having a serious conversation with what is happening today in the world, what's happening with music, what's happening with art, and what's happening politically and socially. It's just we're engaged in a much, much bigger conversation. And I have to say, I think that the new social media has played a gigantic role in this.
Totally agree.
I think it's not a coincidence that this material is available in so many forms and so quickly that it really starts to spread. And unlike when I was a kid and I would just wait for the original cast LP to come out,
and the Tony broadcast,
listen to it, and the Tony broadcast, that was it, man.
Yeah.
If you weren't, you know, if you didn't live in New York City and you couldn't actually go to Broadway and see the stuff, that was your way, and you had to wait. It was like waiting for The Wizard of Oz to come on. Once a year. Only you had to see it once a year. There were no VCRs.
Right.
There were no DVDs, God knows. But you couldn't even – there was no way to get content other than when the powers that be would allow it to come to you.
Right.
And now we're just living in a new world. And I think the new world – is allowing for new work, and I just think it's thrilling. It's an honor to be a little tiny part of that, and it's thrilling to watch what people are coming with.
Well, we're all really thankful for the part you've played.
Well, truly, it's very cool, and I hope to keep trying to do more work. But luckily, there are a lot of people out there who are also working all the time, and I just love to see what everyone's coming up with. I really do.
Yeah. Well, I have to say a huge thank you for all the work you did in American Idiot. It's just been amazing working on this material. We opened this week, and we just can't wait to share it with the audience. It's an extraordinary piece of theater.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I hope it goes great.
Yeah, oh, it's selling like crazy, of course.
Yeah. And I hope it'll kill the people every night.
Yeah, pretty awesome. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. This has been really fun.
My pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. This is Scott Miller. Now you, too, have achieved stage grok. See you next time.